Welcome to the new Tyndale House podcast. We're working to make high-level Bible research available to you to help you understand the Bible more and explore reasons why the Bible can be trusted. Tyndale House is an international centre for Bible research and a community of Christian Bible scholars in Cambridge, England. In this first series, we're re-releasing the Trusting the Bible podcast, which was made in collaboration between Tyndale House and the Bible Society in 2020. Dr. Andrew Ollerton will sit down with three Bible scholars to discuss the reliability, relevance, and reality of the four gospel accounts. In this episode, Dr. Andrew Ollerton and Dr. Peter Williams discuss how we think about trustworthiness in everyday life and how we approach the question of the credibility of the four Gospels. As well as being principal of Tyndale House, Peter is also the author of Can We Trust the Gospels and The Surprising Genius of Jesus, both published by Crossway.
Well, welcome to this podcast series. My name's Andrew Ollerton. I work with Bible Society. I'm joined by Dr. Peter J. Williams, who is principal of Tyndale House. And together, as organisations, we're partnering with this podcast series to raise confidence in the Bible, something we're all passionate about. Peter, great to have you with us
today. Great to be with you.
And just share a little bit, you know, Tyndale House, we're here in Cambridge, recording it on site. What is Tyndale House? What do you get up to?
Well, Tyndale House is a research centre for the Bible with a library, the best library in Britain. And people come from around the world, not the best library of the Bible in Britain, let's say. And people come from around the world to study there. We get a community of 50 people researching the Bible at the doctoral level or above. But our heart is that our research should serve the church and help people to be excited about the Bible.
Great. And you're obviously principal of Tyndale House. What do you focus on? What's your day job?
Well, it's quite varied, but I get to lead the organisation, set the vision and represent it publicly, as well as carry out research, teaching, speaking and so on. Great. So I've got an absolutely great team here.
Great. And somehow you get time to write books and various things as well. We've got, you've recently released the book, Can We Trust the Gospels, with Crossway, which I've read and really enjoyed along with many other people. Encourage our listeners to get hold of a copy. And obviously this is a lifetime passionate of yours. Mm-hmm. Could you just backtrack though? I say lifetime, I don't know that for sure. Yeah. When did you... Tell us a little bit about your faith journey. Yeah. How have you come to a place where this matters to you?
Yeah, so I had the privilege of growing up in a Christian family, but coming to university and coming across a whole load of different ideas, you really realise that these things are incredibly disputed, and that sent me through a stage of doubt and searching and finding answers and eventually sharing answers. And so one of the things I've been thinking about for the last 20 or more years was this subject of the trustworthiness of the Gospels. And I tried to write all the thoughts I'd had that were worthwhile in 140 pages. So I wanted to make it very condensed and simple. I didn't want to use technical language unnecessarily. I just want to explain things. So it's for an absolute beginner or someone who's been studying the Gospels for quite a few years. I hope they'd both get a lot from
it. Yeah, well, that was what struck me. Thank you for making it short. I know that took you
Lots of people write long books.
Yeah, exactly. I know it takes you a lot longer to write a short book, which is the irony, but I think really grateful for that, because I know how much goes on in your mind, or some of it, but you've got it down, you've condensed it down to something very accessible. And I suppose that reflects a concern then that you and Tyndale House share about actually good scholarship is something that everyone can engage with, and every Christian, I suppose, can have an opportunity to really think for themselves on these things.
That's right. I think an analogy I often use is with the sort of ingredients that we have on tins and food and these sort of things, where we're not all dietary experts, but we're all taking a bit of an interest. Mm. Nowadays, every parent feels they have to read ingredients sometimes in order to know what's in it. And so I think it's the same way with the Bible. It's not that everyone's going to be a scholarly expert on the Bible, but everyone can take an interest in the nuts and bolts of how it's come to us and what we can say about it. So that's what I'm encouraging people to do, to just take an interest.
Mm, that's great. Yeah, good analogy. So Pete, like every author, you probably chose your title carefully. And I noticed you landed on, can we trust the Gospels? Not, you know, can we prove the Gospels? Let's start with that word trust. You know, what's your, what do you mean by that? And how what's your ambition for this book? What would it mean to trust the Gospels?
Well, trust is something that every human exercises every day. We are social creatures and we depend on each other for our lives, literally. When we consume food, we buy food from shops, you know, there's enough that we're consuming that if it were poison, we'd be dead. And we can't not rely on what the shop supply or, you know, what other people supply. You can try and imagine going off on and living on your own and not relying on anyone else. And it's going to be exceedingly difficult. And so because trust is something we exercise every day, that's actually something we can't avoid doing coming to the Bible. People are often looking for some sort of mathematical or philosophical proof, when really what the Bible's presenting to us is God as a person. And we are wired so that we know how to decide whether to trust people or not. We sometimes make mistakes, but fundamentally, we are all making decisions about whether to trust people or not. And so this is where this question of, can we trust the Gospels at a personal level? Do they come across as credible reporting? That's something that I'm wanting to ask. I think it's the right question to ask. The question, can we prove everything in the Gospels to be true mathematically? No, you can't. You can't prove the most important things in life. You can't prove your mother loves you. You can't prove that life has a purpose in those sort of ways. You can't prove the value of a human being using a mathematical proof. So and even science, which people say is, you know, is about proof, you can't. There's no scientific experiment you can conduct to show you that science has a value. So science, you've got to believe in the value of science in order to do it.
And we're talking here history, aren't we? So I suppose in that sense, which by definition is unrepeatable. So there's a sense in
unrepeatable,
which...
But yeah, that's right. And so you look at categories of personal trustworthiness when it comes to testimony.
Okay. So that's particular. So within the context of the Gospels and history, we're thinking here, are the accounts that we have, I mean, the four Gospels that are included in the Bible, are they trustworthy? That's the question at stake. And before we get into the detail of why you've come to the conviction that they are, and you've, you know, that's been pretty well road tested in academia and all sorts of contexts where you've had to think that one through. Let's just, for the sake of our listeners, and revisit, what are the Gospels? You know, we've got these four, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In essence, what are they? How would you summarize them?
So the four Gospels you have at the beginning of any New Testament are the earliest accounts that we have of Jesus's life, and they focus particularly on his teaching, his activities, and his death and resurrection. So that they have this, they're not trying to tell you everything about what happened in life, they have this focus. And they're about 9 hours worth of text if you read them through out loud.
Okay, so would you describe them as something like ancient biographies then? What sort of phrase would you use to say what kind of
style? We can think of them as biographies, provided we recognise that the way we would do things is somewhat different, because we would, if someone lived for 70 years and we had 7 chapters, we'd tend to do about 10 years per chapter. Yes. And the way the Gospels work is about a third to a quarter of the entire Gospel is taken up with that last week of Jesus' life leading up to his death and resurrection. That's the focus. So it's presenting Jesus as God's Son come into the world to save us, and it doesn't drift from that.
Okay, so that almost that's a clue, isn't it? I mean, if you're going to spend up to a third or half of the Gospel on one final week, it's more of a message than a sort of neutral biography, if you like.
Yeah, so even the word Gospel, meaning the good news, is therefore telling you it's not just a record of history, it's also particularly meaningful history of events that matter to all of us.
So what do you say, given that's the case, what do you say then to those who, because I hear this plenty of times where people will say, well, precisely for that reason, they're not reliable because they're clearly biased. I mean, you know, they're not writing history in the sort of objective sense. They are, you know, putting a spin on things because they got a message. You know, what do you say to those who say, well, the Gospel writers are Christians, therefore it's not proper history?
Well, I think sometimes the problem is the category of history, that we can think of that as just about dispassionate facts which have no meaning. But when we think about, say, accounts there were of the Holocaust. Elie Wiesel's book Night, Alexander Solzhenitsyn's record The Gulag Archipelago. These are witnesses of tragedies and terrible events. And to say that we shouldn't trust them because they have an argument about what is right and wrong, it makes no sense at all. And I think that, let's say someone does a great injustice to someone, they may be very invested in the argument that an injustice has been done against them. A victim is going to feel victimized, and so on. Does that mean you can't trust anything that they present in terms of evidence? This isn't the way it works at all. So I think that we've got to move away from, I mean, history departments are great, but remember that in terms of deciding the meanings of things, that we've got to come to something a little bit more every day, that we every day recognize there are witnesses to events that matter. And so here we have people writing to us saying these events happen, they matter. They should be classed as testimony and evaluated as such in the way that we normally do.
Okay, so testimony is an interesting word as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a word that comes up again and again, yes. Testimony.
Yeah, they've seen something, or they've had some access to eyewitnesses who've seen something, and they're bearing witness to that, which, okay. And so in terms of these Gospels then, we've got four of them, which in itself is interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, partly because that's a lot, and there's a content-rich element to this, which, mm-hmm. I mean, could you share something about that? Because you pick up on this in the book, that actually it's unusual. It's whereas we might be more used to the plethora of books that surround, you know, our world, and so maybe there are several biographies about Winston Churchill or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's our reality. But back in the first century, when the Gospels were originally authored, this was unusual, right? Could you share a bit more about why four is unusual?
Yes, well, I mean, it was unusual that you should have books written about someone who isn't from the elite classes or dead long ago. So that's already strange that you have these Gospels. Then we recognise that actually almost no one has that much written about them. Even the most famous person alive at the time, namely the Roman Emperor Tiberius, really only four major accounts of his life, and on a whole, they are shorter and somewhat later, somewhat more distant from the events than we have with Jesus. So I'd say Jesus's life is very well attested. And in fact, when we look at that last week leading up to his death and resurrection, this is the best attested week in antiquity, you know, in terms of the number of different testimonies we have about it.
So that I suppose that's just the sheer volume, right? Mm-hmm. And but also you're picking up, which is interesting as well, that it's not just the volume, it's the fact of this was a, I mean, this is a life from lived largely in an incredibly isolated and insignificant location, right? I mean, in terms of Nazareth and Galilee, the locations themselves not particularly eye-catching.
I would say insignificant, yes, in the sense that these are not places of which had otherwise made a historical mark. In terms of isolated, I would say less so. You see, I mean, Capernaum's actually on a major trade route. I mean, one of the things about the Israel and the Holy Land, Palestine, whatever you want to call it is at the juncture between continents. And I think actually, you know, one of my arguments for the reliability of the Gospels is that the people that Jesus came across who witnessed things were not as ignorant and as uneducated as some people might want to make out. So, you know, Capernaum is a place of commerce and so on. Nazareth, yes, much more of a backwater, you know, but even then, it's not that far from a significant city.
So Jesus obviously lived his life there, and we played out in Jerusalem in the final week and so forth, and the Gospels record this. But just in terms of the stages you've got from the, just for the sake of our listeners, just helping tease this out, from when Jesus actually, if you like, spoke and did and acted in the world, through to when the Gospels were actually first penned and brought to paper. Tell us a little bit about the journey and how you understand that period.
Yeah, and there's a lot that we don't know. So the Gospels come with these names, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John on. I think they are by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Mm-hmm. Matthew and John being disciples of Jesus, one of each one of the 12 disciples, Matthew being a tax collector, John being a fisherman. Mark, I think, got his information from Peter, who was a disciple, and Luke is a doctor who did a lot of investigation. But in terms of the dates they're written, they don't give us dates, but they have to be written within the lifetimes of people who could plausibly be disciples and early followers of Jesus. So that gives us some limits. How do they get their information? We get some hints about this in terms of Luke saying that he investigated things. But with Matthew and John, of course, they were disciples. And disciple only has one job, that is to learn, to follow, to do what their master says. And so if Jesus is presented repeatedly in the Gospels as a teacher, and they are presented as learners or students of his, then it's not really surprising that they should be able to pass things on. Now, people have these technical debates about how much people wrote down at the time, how good people's memories were. But the point is, it doesn't actually matter how good people's individual memories are if you have a good teacher who makes sure that they learn. I think Jesus would check up and make sure that they'd learnt it. And if you have to go through the lesson one more time, then you do that. So I think there's a very thick bandwidth to get reliable accounts of the teaching of Jesus from him to the books.
Okay. But just say a bit, I get that, but just say a bit more about that, because obviously, nevertheless, part of it is we're in a digital world now, aren't we? You know, memory is something that we have on our phones more than in our brains now, isn't it?
Sure.
Increasingly. What are your thoughts about the, we call it the oral tradition, don't we? We call it this period of time where, rather than it being necessarily, at least in the current form of the Gospels, fully written down, some of what Jesus said and did is being passed on through through word of mouth, if you like.
Yep.
And that sounds to us intrinsically unreliable. In that context, what are your thoughts about the reliability of the period where the teachings of Jesus are being held within this eyewitness community?
So often what people do is they take us to general studies of how reliable oral traditions are, and they can vary a lot. And I would prefer not to go there, because I would say we can get into the details of the Gospels and see they clearly know what they're talking about. They clearly have high quality information. The question of how they got that is a separate question. So, I mean, there are theories that people used waxed writing tablets and they could write down contemporaneously with Jesus. Someone like Matthew's a tax collector. He would have had to write an awful lot of receipts in his life. You know, don't pay tax without getting a receipt. and so on. But there's another side, which is whether or not they wrote things down, he's a teacher and he has 12 learners. That's the whole idea of having disciples. He has a school he has more than just the 12, and he teaches repeatedly. So you can see certain things, say in Matthew's gospel, where he teaches the same thing more than once. He teaches about divorce more than once. He teaches if you're... I offend you, pluck it out more than once. The phrase, he who has ears to hear, let him hear, occurs many times. There are certain things which he would say repeatedly. And I think that the idea that these things can't be passed down properly is problematic. So even in the thing that we call the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5 through to 7, we think of it now as a sermon. But what it actually says is he opened his mouth and he taught them, saying. So it doesn't call it a sermon, it calls it a lesson, effectively. Rather than having to think, oh, could they do shorthand and, you know, memorize this all in the spot, you can think, oh, actually, this is a whole syllabus we've got. He also sends out his disciples to do their own sermons. So does he help go over their outlines and prepare that? How much material do they get? And when he goes, as it says, from village to village, you know, does he use a different sermon every night, or does he use the same? I mean, I've given some talks like 100 times. My brother was once working with a very famous artist as his PA, and he said by the end he could do the stand-up show, you know, almost from memory. That's repetition just occurs.
Yeah, okay.
And in that context, you can have a lot of potential for good things being handed down, right things being handed down.
Including some of the differences then. So the Beatitudes in Matthew's Gospel, they are recurring in Luke, but with slight differences. And your view would be, well, Jesus said that several times, and maybe the nuances...
Yeah, well, look, if you've come up with sayings or memes as good as that? Mm. Would you only ever use them once? Yeah. I mean, really, you know, yeah. when you've taught them to people, you crafted these amazing pieces that are steeped in Old Testament reference, that have alliterative structures in them in Greek and so on, would you only use them once? It's almost inconceivable. Mm. And the Gospels effectively tell us that Jesus repeated sayings. So why would we expect him not to do that? I mean, I think a lot of it is failing to take seriously the idea that he is an itinerant teacher. Mm.
So in a sense, getting from the events and the spoken words of Jesus through to the text that we have, the Gospels today, in a sense, you put the emphasis on, as I hear it, the genius of Jesus as a teacher and the repetition of him as a teacher, combined with the disciples, who were more than one, as you say, and the fact that in that culture you remembered stuff. I mean, there was a memory capacity that we've perhaps lost today as well.
Yeah, so you think about the story of the two sons, the prodigal son. It's a brilliant, amazing, powerful story. If you've thought up that story, are you only going to tell it once? Mm. I mean, it seems to me an absurd idea. Mm. So I think, of course, this is something that Jesus would repeat.
So almost remember, I mean, one of the things I'm taking from this is, as you read the Gospels, remember this is a sort of condensed and contracted summary of what was played out over years and therefore in multiple occasions, but has a reliability to it, even precisely because of that repetition and repeat. So just as you think then, a couple of questions as we bring this into land, part one, but I just think, firstly, as you think about the record we have of Jesus as compared to any other equivalent figure in history, particularly in antiquity, what gives you confidence, particular confidence, that we can actually know Jesus through the Gospels?
I think that's a huge question, and there are so many things I probably can't get them into a short answer. And the reason why is because there are lots and lots of converging lines of evidence with Jesus. So I've just been speaking, in a sense, about the historical testimony line, but there's also the argument that you could make from prophecy, where it seems that there are bits in the Holy Scriptures of the Jews that fit beforehand very well with Jesus's life. Jesus's life and death also have meaning, a significance, saving the world. All of these things come together, and they mutually reinforce, I'd say. But just sticking with the sort of historical testimony of the Gospels, I would say that we can test the Gospels. We can see that they have lots and lots of local knowledge of multiple kinds. So you can test their knowledge of geography or weather or law or local customs, and they get them right every time. They also have literary patterns which show reliability. That is, you have overlap between Matthew and Luke. You have overlap between Mark and Matthew and Luke, but then you have bits which fit with John and so on. And when we look at these four Gospels, we have at least five types of material, in fact, amongst them. And we can test each one of those, and we find that they all seem to be locally knowledgeable and so on. So these things come together. And then you have to explain, how did Christianity get going? I mean, I think the whole idea that this religion took root is so much easier to explain with the death and the resurrection of Jesus. The death on its own, you know, crucified guy, why would anyone follow that at all? So I think it's these things coming together, making sense as a whole.
And in that sense, the word trust, back to that, whilst you can't put the object in a test tube and perform some experiment on it, actually, and we'll come on to this in part two, you've begun to whet our appetite for some of that, but there's a sense in which you can actually run some tests and cross-referencing and so forth, and that gives us a real confidence we can trust that as we read the Gospels, well, I suppose, and this is what I was going to just come to as we bring this into land, just very personally now, I mean, I presume, you know, on a daily basis or whenever you can, you're going to be reading the Bible. And and so as you, I want to imagine sort of, you know, Pete Williams, you're reading the Gospels and you're all of that background, you know, all the journey you've been on in scholarship and research. How does that affect the way that you actually experience it and read it?
Well, I think every day, you know, wake up and know that God's given us this day and that God's a loving father. We are wayward children and that he has sent his son into the world to save us. And this is, you know, the message that's come through very clearly from the Gospels, and you can know that we are forgiven because of Christ's death on the cross.
So in that sense, the confidence, I suppose, is changes the experience. And I think this is part of the thing I hope we are sharing through you know, channeling your experience and knowledge, is almost that as we, for our listeners, as they read the Gospels, confidence can rise, and therefore the experience increases as well.
Absolutely.
Pete, looking forward to part two.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Tyndale House podcast, which was a re-release from the Trusting the Bible podcast, produced by Tyndale House Cambridge in collaboration with the Bible Society. In our next episode, Andrew Orleton continues his conversation with Peter Williams as they consider who the gospel authors were and whether we can trust them.
So, I mean, some people have this idea that the Gospels were written a very long time later or in a very different place. Now, they could have been written in a very different place, but they have to be written on the basis either of having been to the land or having had really extended research conversations with people in the land. Either way, reliable information can get passed down. But the idea that they got things wrong because of some extensive telephone game method, that is falsified by this, because simply you wouldn't get those sorts of details passed down if it were going through many, many steps.
In future series, we will be exploring how to make sense of the Old Testament, digging into names in the Bible and the ancient world, and talking in depth to some of the people who study and work here in the Tyndale House Library. Please subscribe to the Tyndale House Cambridge podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts so that you don't miss late episodes. It really helps others to find this podcast if you pass it on to your friends and colleagues, and if you rate and review it.